Welcome to Leadership Bites with myself, your host, Guy Bloom. This is a leadership podcast where I have conversations with colleagues, I chat with guests, and sometimes they'll be just me talking. You can connect with me at livingbrave.com, and when you enjoy the episode, subscribe and please tell everyone. Sir Jay, it is fantastic to have you on this episode of Leadership Bites. Thank you and welcome.
Thank you so much for having me today.
Well, you know what? I'm super pleased you're here. We've got lots to talk about and we've been chatting before we've got going. But just for me, Jay, if you would introduce yourself to the audience just to give them a sense of who you are and your context.
I'm Jay Busada, the founder and CEO of a company called Thrillworks. I currently live in Ontario, Canada, but I grew up in Quebec in the 70s, right around the time when English was outlawed, which was kind of tough on a family of English speakers. My mom was an emergency room nurse, so you kind of need to know the language if you're going to do that job. And my dad is an entrepreneur. Likewise, it makes the job kind of hard if English is outlawed. But that entrepreneurship kind of rubbed off because two of my three brothers and I all went on to start our own businesses. Mostly in my case, you know, I've just been fascinated with finding ways to make, you know, the stuff around me in the world work better. And so not surprisingly, I went on to become an engineer, and in that process discovered this new thing called the internet, which ultimately let me, you know, start a glorious 23 career in the internet business. And you know, many lessons have been learned along the way, but I you know, really have been fortunate to have, you know, gotten to where I am, and love sharing the things that I've learned along the way.
Well, we're going to pick up on those, but before you do, you've just thrown something in there that I've got to ask a question about. I thought that English had been ordered to be the business language, but you could talk it, but he's saying actually outlawed.
Well, for all intents and purposes, you couldn't really greet anybody in English. All business and legal transactions had to be done exclusively in French. And if you had exhausted all French possibilities, then you could resort to English, but it was a last resort. So, you know, it was kind of an extreme law. And, you know, it was done for good purposes, but it just ended up producing a bunch of bad results. And so it was really challenging. You know, my parents couldn't speak. You know, we went to French school. My three brothers and I went to French school. But as a result of not being able to speak, there was a lot of persecution. My mom was, you know, physically attacked a couple times in our house by people that were angry, you know, that my dad was an English business person. My dad's brakes were cut. His business was ultimately burned to the ground by arsonists. So it was a challenging time. But, you know, so many of my life lessons today and resilience come from the lessons that my parents taught and the lessons that I learned growing up in that environment, in that family. So, you know, in a weird way, I can appreciate some of the resilience that the entire family got. And I think, like I said, with a father, a grandfather, and two brothers that all own, you know, different businesses, you know, I think resilience is a really important aspect to have, or a really important attribute to have if you're going to start your own company.
So just bring to life for people Thrillworks. What is it? What does it do? Where's its market? What does it focus on?
Well, we're what you call a digital acceleration partner. So what that means in its simplest form is we help companies create and deliver, you know, their digital products faster and more successfully than they could on their own. So we have a process that we've been refining over 23 years to help customers get their products, their digital products. So it could be a website, could be an app, could be an online service of some kind. And we usually do this for enterprise level clients because what we build has to be evolved over time. So, you know, maintenance has to be performed. So you have to be a relatively large organization to be able to afford to build large scale software and then support it after it's been built. So if all you want to do is build yourself a website and say, great, my job's done for the next 5 years, we're definitely not, you know, the right company for you. But, you know, we have this process that uses a build, measure, learn approach where, you know, it comes very much from the agile form of thinking. Build something, put it into market as fast as you can, measure the results that you're having, take the input that you're getting from the market, you know, tweak it, put it back there as quickly as you can, and iterate that process over and over and over. So lots of companies do that. You know, our superhuman trick, if you will, is exposing and exploiting that overlooked opportunity that exists in every business, because we think, you know, that is where you're really going to start accelerating your results, right? It's easy to go and add a new feature to your app, or, you know, add more whiz bang or drive more traffic to your website thinking that you're going to get better results, but that's rarely the case, right? Like everywhere in life, your success is really limited by the most friction point in your life. So instead of just going and adding more speed to things, what we try to do is remove friction first.
Okay. So easily said, but when you say 23 years as an organization that's now thriving, that this is rhetorical because I know where we're going, but the reality is this, it's not a straight road, right? There's zigs and zags and ups and downs. So it'd be great to kind of get a sense of, almost maybe I'd be interested from that moment of inception where you went, right, I think what I'm going to do is, and maybe what you thought the journey was going to be, and then the reality of, oh, righty-ho then, this may not be as straightforward as I thought it might be. I don't know, I wasn't there. But, you know, let's start at that point of you having a kernel of an idea and boom, off we go.
Well, backing up, when I was getting my engineering degree, that's when I stumbled across the internet. I think I mentioned that earlier. And it just fascinated me. And what I think fascinated me is I saw the internet, you know, similar to the way, you know, the analogy that I might use would be, the internet to me is kind of like the operating system on a computer. So if you use a Mac, you have a Mac OS or Windows. I see the internet as an operating system. And so, you know, unlike a computer that you got to change out or constantly upgrade the software on, I saw this like massive superpower that was just sitting out there for somebody to be able to build on. So I just got fascinated with it from the moment that I first saw it in the early 90s, and, you know, always kind of like kept it on the side, and it was almost a hobby for me to like learn about and play with. But after doing the engineering thing for, you know, 3 or 4 years, I just couldn't ignore the passion that I had for it anymore. So I put myself into night school, learned how to program, and then started, you know, building applications for whoever would let me back in the time. And then one day just, you know, got up and quit my engineering job, and my timing could have been a lot better. I went home and told my wife at the time, who was 9 months pregnant, that I just quit my job. So that didn't go over very well.
She loved that.
And 9 months later, the dot-com boom hit, because it was around 2000. But thankfully, like so many businesses, you know, luck plays a really big part in the journey. And so we had enough success and momentum in that first year to carry us through the dot-com boom. And then, you know, we started applying a really different way of looking at the world. When I started the company, I'd never worked inside anything similar before. And so I invented everything the way I thought it should be invented. Now, a lot of that involved reinventing the wheel, which was a waste of time. But a lot of the stuff about, you know, how we treat customers and how we go about thinking about the solutions was really different. So that gave us, you know, almost a straight line of growth for the first 12 years. And then, of course, after 12 straight years of success, I think I have it all figured out. So the next thing you do is graduate yourself into a management role and away from the project work. And from year 12 through 17, it got incredibly difficult to keep clients as happy as they were before, to have success, to make profit.
And just to jump in there, is this a point of being going for 12 years? Yes, we've had growth, but now I'm looking to scale. Is that the segue point?
Well, I wish I could say it was conscious. You know, one of the things that was a disadvantage to getting an engineering degree is you get really good at, you know, developing a process for solving problems, but you have no business sense. And so, you know, what I knew was that we were too big for me to ignore the management responsibilities of the company. So I just did what I thought came next, and that is start managing and stop doing the work. So it was less conscious. And as a result of that, I wasn't conscious about making sure that I passed along the vision as clearly as I could to the rest of the company, passed along the values that I was making decisions based on and the thinking that I was using to make some of the project decisions, because the team was amazing. You know, they would just kind of roll up their sleeves and, you know, get behind me and, you know, we would tackle the world. But when you back away and you don't give anybody the formula that you're using, you know, they're doing their best to just, you know, do what they think that you would do when you're not there. And projects just became harder to have success with, and profits, you know, started to dwindle. And like I say, one day in 2017, I walked into the company and I just didn't love what I saw anymore. It wasn't the company that I wanted to create. We had kind of stalled out, and I decided I had three choices: sell it, shut it down, or reinvent it. And reinventing just required taking us back to our core values, which like was literally like rebooting a company, which, you know, is exactly what I did. So in 2017, I started reinventing myself by figuring out what a leader really had to be. And that was the first time that I started to become conscious about how leadership needs to play a big part in my company. Don't just do what you think comes next, but get serious about, you know, being intentional. And so we were very fortunate to last until 2017 and get away with it for that long, you know, just acting on instinct. But what a difference it's made, and what a journey it's been. The last 5 years have been probably as tumultuous as all 17 years previous combined.
So a point of reinvention. So I work with senior leaders, people who are in executive teams, and very often they have a way, they have a habit of being, and sometimes it's really working. So, hey, you know, keep going and calibrate it and flipping fantastic. And for others, it's not. But reinvention can feel scary for them because I've defined my brand. People have a sense of who and what I am. I'd have to probably look in the mirror, etc. So you say you went on that sort of point of reinvention, maybe even transformation. Easy to say as a throwaway. What was the reality of that journey for you?
Scary is a great word for it. I think, you know, I was pretending not to know that I needed to do this. And I think a lot of us who are avoiding doing what needs to be done just pretend not to know. And, you know, I reached that point where I was more dissatisfied with the results that I was getting than I was scared of making a change, whatever that change was. And so, you know, the first thing that I did is take a look around and, you know, ask myself, like, what do successful people do? Like wildly successful people who remain successful. So, you know, I'm not, I don't know a lot about sports, admittedly, but I do spend a lot of time, you know, researching the art of coaching, like how coaches show up. And all the best athletes in the world don't have fewer coaches or no coaches. They have more coaches than most other high performing athletes. So I thought, who the heck am I not to get myself a coach? So I went looking for somebody who would help reflect back to me how I was showing up in the world, so I could get out of my own way. Because I knew the lack of results that I was getting, the lack of satisfaction and joy that I had was a product of who I was. And, you know, back on the coaching theme, you know, I think my personality was one more of a counselor than a coach. A coach is going to, you know, drive you to get results, but they're never going to get on the field for you. And a counselor, you know, really wants you to have success, but they'll stick around for as long as you need them to, typically, regardless of how much progress you're making. So I ended up being that person who oftentimes saw potential in people and wanted it more for them than they wanted it for themselves. And, you know, you can't run a business that way, and you can't run a world-class life that way, right? So, you know, the first thing that I had to do was learn to get out of my own way and change my own thinking. So I found myself a coach, and I surrounded myself with other entrepreneurs by joining a couple of organizations that were committed to reflecting back to me how I was showing up in the world. And that was the first step, right? You can't change what you're unaware of. So I decided, let's like lift the veil and get really clear on how I'm showing up in the world, and then be intentional about who I want to be.
Yeah, there's quite a lot in there. Being intentional is a very, you know, that phrase, you know, conscious competence, that doing it on purpose.
Yeah.
Yeah, we exactly all know that, you know, being, you know, unconsciously incompetent and those sort of stepping stones. But that, I think I found a word for this. Well, I found a word for it. There's a word for this called craft. And it's having that sort of sense of, what does a sportsman have? You know, they have craft. What does somebody that creates ceramic pots to a very good level, they have craft. So it doesn't matter what it is, but anything good has a craft. And everybody wants to be unconsciously competent, right? They just want to have that inverted commas flow state. But I'm pretty sure that comes from conscious competence, which is consciously getting good at it on purpose. So you then hit these moments of flow and everybody wants to jump to this kind of other space. But I think that's what I'm hearing in there, that intentional practice, that exposing myself to other entrepreneurs, people in my space who can offer me my blind spots and, you know, reinforce the stuff that's good. But there's a relationship with vulnerability. And I wonder how easy that was for you to go, yeah, okay, now I've thought about it. That's not a problem. Silly me for not having done it before. Or, yeah, intellectually, I know what I'm asking myself to do. But, oh, God, now I've got to get feedback. And how was that for you, that vulnerability piece?
Well, the coach that I chose is... He's quite unique in that his approach to vulnerability is to just charge right at you. Now, I'd been exposed to this person in a couple group settings before as a facilitator, and I really liked his style because it was a no-nonsense approach. So we weren't tippy-toeing into vulnerability at all. It was, you know, almost painfully awakening on the vulnerability side, but once I started seeing the benefits of being vulnerable, admitting that I didn't know, admitting that I was the one that was responsible for my own results, you know, admitting that the results that I was getting were perfect for the way I was showing up in the world, right? And if I wanted different results, I had to show up differently. You know, it's funny that you mentioned flow. We actually talk a lot about those, you know, those concepts, because if we're going to be a good leader of our own life, and if we're going to be a good leader to others, meaning not only show them proper leadership, but help them become the best version of a leader they can, I think, you know, concepts like flow are really important because, you know, flow doesn't just happen, right? I think, you know, if we can riff on that for just a second, you know, if you look at some of the research on flow, it's, you know, there's this beautiful little chart that's an oversimplified version of his work. And I can never pronounce, you know, the researcher's name, but it's that skill versus, you know, challenge, where if you give somebody too much of a challenge that's too far beyond their skills, they're way outside their flow zone. And if you give them too little challenge and they've got too much skill, you put them outside their flow zone. Both of those areas, if taken to extremes, are awful and demotivating. But if you actually kind of, you know, and this is where I went with my coaching first, like, how do we get me just outside the flow zone so that, you know, we can build the skill and you keep climbing up that flow channel. You get better and better and better at doing the thing that you weren't even clear existed just, you know, a short while ago. So vulnerability is definitely the most important part of this. It's a founding part of of how we run the company, of how we show up for our customers. Once I discovered that, to your point, I've never looked back. You know, we start with a concept that was first discussed, I think, by Patrick Lencioni in The Five Dysfunctions of a Team, where, you know, he talks about what creates a dysfunctional team so he can help people understand how to create a very high-performing functional team. And the very bottom of his model, the bottom of the pyramid, is vulnerability-based trust. If you don't have that, forget getting to goals. A team will never actually act like a team if they can't get to vulnerability-based trust. And whether you're talking about an internal team or a team with, you know, between us and our customer, without that, you're going to limit your success and your ability to get anywhere.
I'm fascinated by this idea of vulnerability. And so my hobby sport interest has always been martial arts all my life. And one of the things you very quickly observe is you have to be willing to fail and to lose consistently, because that's the only way you're going to learn. And it's also the only way that people are going to be happy to coach you and teach you. If you're going to push back, if you're going to challenge all the time, if you're going to be argumentative, if you're going to try and validate why you did things instead of just listening and shutting up and, you know, making another move kind of thing, then you very quickly see people quite isolated. Nobody wants to kind of spend time with them and engage with them, so that, because they're not willing to be vulnerable. And sometimes people give you observations and feedback that don't sit right with you, but that's the stuff of life. But if the majority of you is, oh, thank you for that, yeah, thanks for the insight, and actually you see it in good training rooms where even the junior, less kind of skilled practitioners can still see things that you can't, even when you've been doing it for decades. So you can see the healthy, where the vulnerability is, I'll be vulnerable to the hierarchy, but the really healthy places are where everybody can comment regardless of the hierarchy. And that's really special when you get that, because then I think there's not just individual flow, there's like a team flow. Does that make sense when I say that to you? Do you recognize that, or does that not resonate?
It completely resonates. Like, one of the founding, you know, edicts of ThrillWorks is creating a world-class team, right? Like, how we show up for our customers is one of our main differentiators. Anybody can actually, you know, build the thing that we do, but how we go about building it, the relationships that we build are really, you know, one of our unique differentiators. And you can't build a team like that without, you know, vulnerability at its core. And, you know, I found, looking back through all of the work that I've done on my own growth and, you know, the growth that I've tried to bring to the company, you know, the easy entry point to vulnerability, I've often found to be curiosity. So, you know, it's a little bit of a hack, but if you use curiosity, it really kind of neuters the defensiveness that you can sometimes see in people. So, you know, really strong leaders listen twice as much as they speak, and they know what questions to ask. They don't provide answers. And in that process, by asking questions, you're also giving people an opportunity to feel heard. And, you know, at least here in North America, you know, we're taught to read and write and speak, but we're never taught to listen. And so, you know, it's a lost art form, but until somebody actually legitimately feels heard, then it's very difficult to get new ideas into their head until they feel like you've really understood them. Then they're prepared for you to influence them. And if you use a little bit of curiosity to actually like get them feel heard, well, why do you think that? And how does that work? And where, how did you get to that conclusion? Somebody will reveal some of that. And before they know it, you know, they're being wildly vulnerable. We actually used a process similar to this while we were uncovering our values. I mentioned that, you know, I rebooted the company in 2017. You know, one of the very early things that I had to go about doing was like getting clear on the values. And now I could go away, sit on a mountaintop and come up with a bunch of values and bring them down on stone tablets and say, you know, these are our values. But that's not the way values of high-performing teams work. So, you know, we use the process that I think was kind of first described by Tony Hsieh from Zappos. And it, before you know it, you know, people who were very not vulnerable as a way of being in life would end the exercise by going, oh my gosh, I can't believe I just said those things. I've never actually been that vulnerable before. And they actually had a sense of pride about it. And so now they could actually see the benefits of starting to be vulnerable. And we got at it through curiosity.
I love that. And there's a phrase, true strength through true vulnerability. You cannot damage me if it's in the open space. If I'm okay with it, then you've got nowhere to go with it. Right. So I think that's a very powerful, I think that's definitely what I'm hearing there. Now, I love that curiosity. You know, one of the things that I think I hear people say in corporate spaces, you know, well, I don't know if I want to challenge, you know, them, you know. And I often say, well, just why don't you start from a place of curiosity? You know, just go in curious. You can always build up to challenge, right?
Yeah.
And that willingness to be curious, you say hack, and I think I know what you mean, because that's the parlance at the moment, but as a vehicle too, as an elegant migration into that topic without setting everybody's alarm. But can I just challenge you there for a moment? You know, can you help me make sense of this, or whatever that phraseology is? I think that's massively important. And you say reboot a company. Give me a size of the organization just so we can contextualize what that is. 5 people, 10 people, 100 people. Where are you size wise, or where were you at the time?
Back in 2017, there was about 42 of us. And between then and now, you know, unfortunately, and there's a point to be made about what I'm about to say, with transitioning people and relationships in our lives when you do go through change. But most of those 42 are no longer with us. They've either chosen to leave or were asked to leave because they didn't share or believe in the values. Or the destination we were headed for. So, you know, since then, those 42 have come and gone, and we've actually had Probably another 100 and 110 people go through the company, and we're about 75 people right now. But you know, it's an art as much as it is a skill to find people who do truly believe in the values. Because when somebody, you know, wants to be part of the team, they'll almost tell you anything, like, oh, sure, I believe in those things, or here's a story where that showed up in my life. And, you know, our job as leaders is to really discover whether or not those people have an alignment, like a goal match. Can they get to where they want to get to in their life by helping us get to where we want to get to? And so having open and transparent conversation is the only way to do that. Like, how are you feeling about this? Like, you know, you didn't show up at your best there. Like, is that because you didn't believe in what we were doing? Were you holding back? And those conversations, I mean, something that you just did that I really liked is, you know, you prefaced the challenge by saying, hey, can I challenge you on that for a second? It's actually asking permission, and it's almost a dirty little trick that you can use. And I don't mean to call these things hacks and tricks because they're bad. I just mean they're not complicated, right? Like, the way to do this stuff isn't, you know, deep, dark, and mysterious. It's quite obvious. We do it in our everyday life, right? Like, hey, I got a thought about that. Can I share my thought? And somebody's far more willing to listen when they give you permission. And so that's kind of how we try to go about everything inside. You know, I believe in the idea of challenge so much that I created a little challenge chip inside the company, because a lot of people come to, you know, a company carrying all the baggage from their past careers. And I'm sure every job that, you know, preceded the career that they have here, somebody somewhere in authority said, no, we'd love to hear your feedback. And at some point somebody gave feedback and they were told, thanks, but keep your opinions to yourself and don't do that again. So they're a little bit scarred. And I really wanted to convince them, we actually mean that your feedback is valuable. So everybody gets a challenge chip when they start. It's basically a poker chip that said, you know, what would Jay want? And what I want is for you to challenge us when you see a problem. And so first address it with your team. But if you really can't feel heard, or if you don't think that your warning signs are being acknowledged, you can play the chip and it stops the project cold in its tracks. And then we bring in some executives to help facilitate a conversation that just isn't happening. And people love it. It's been used about, you know, on average about 8 to 10 times a year. It's not abused, and people just love that you're sincere about it.
Yeah. So use it wisely. Yep. Because there might be some conversation about why you used it unwisely.
Right.
But if you're going to play, but you can play the chip, but you've got to be sure that it's from a place of transparency, integrity, you truly believe. So if you're going to play it, yeah, and then there's no penalty, I guess. Even if it turns out not in your favor, yeah, that would be the big thing. There can't,
exactly,
be a,
right,
there can't be a penalty. As long as you did it the right way, there cannot be repercussions.
Yeah, and you don't have a conversation in this scenario or whatever, you know, if this idea is appealing. Like, you don't have the conversation with the person who played the chip by themselves. Meaning, you know, you have the conversation with the whole team. This person played the chip. You're having the conversation in front of the entire team. Meaning somebody's not going to play the chip if they have an axe to grind with somebody just for political reasons. You know, like, they don't like the look on their face, for example. Because they know that they're going to have to face a team conversation if they play the chip. But, you know, if they actually have a passion for the thing that they don't feel hurt about, they're going to play the chip and they're going to be okay having that conversation out in the open. Again, driving towards, you know, that trust building, transparency, like, you know, we're going to explain why we're doing things so that everybody has the understanding that I might have, because I want you to make the decisions that I would make if I'm not there. And you can't do that if you don't have the information that I would have. So transparency is a really important thing to us. And once you have that trust and people understand who one another are, then they're far more willing to get into ideological conflict. Not, you know, arguments over, like, you know, political arguments inside an organization or opinion-based arguments. But if I know you and we both agree that we're trying to get to this goal, you and I can debate on the best way to get there. And I don't get offended that you aren't agreeing with me because, A, I know something about you and I trust you, and B, we're arguing about the best way to get to the goal. It's that ideological. So conflict isn't a bad thing. Conflict actually creates a better outcome. And then when people actually get to that outcome and have gone through conflict, they've all weighed in. Now people will commit. And once they, like, explicitly commit, this is where accountability first shows up. Because you can't hold people accountable to something that they haven't committed to. And how can you get them to commit if they don't actually, like, weigh in? And weighing in is just a different way of saying, that they're going to have ideological conflict. And they're doing all this, you know, to serve the goal that you're trying to achieve or the results that you're trying to get. And so there is this, you know, mechanic where teams do behave very similar to an individual, right? Like, you need to trust yourself to try new things. Teams need to trust one another to push themselves.
So I have this phrase, which is compassionate conflict, which is we may enter into conflict, but we're going to do it with compassion. And you could say any phrase, but we had two C's and it sounded good when I said it. So I'll start with it. But the point being, I think that's right, isn't it? Because we've got to have tension. We've got to have the ability to speak truth to power. However, there is this line of we can't let the tail wag the dog. And I think that balance is precarious if it's not done well. I think if you let, and I'd really like your thoughts on this, the danger of this system becoming more powerful than the executive team or the person that's driving it, because we've now set, and I've worked with some organizations where they wanted to live and breathe a certain set of values, and they almost, I wouldn't say abdicated, but pushed down ownership to the level where the team, if I would call it that, but the staff members almost took control of the company through challenge and holding people to account for almost an unrealistic set of behaviors that starts to damage and jam up the ability to have a honest, they got an honest became brutal. You know, they, oh, you can't be that brutal. You can't be that, you can't talk like that. Well, hold on. There's a difference between me being aggressive and forthright. There's a difference between me holding you to account and micromanaging you. But depending on where I, if I want to take it, I can use certain vocabulary to make you look like the aggressor when actually what you're doing is you're driving hard. So I just kind of wonder how that sits with you as an observation of what I've just said.
Well, I completely agree. That is, we got ourselves into those situations, and we got ourselves there because we were trying to, we stopped at the idea of values. So we put values in place and we're like, that's enough, right? It really isn't enough. I mean, there's a couple things that have to be in place. One, values are the context, almost the rules of the game, right? But what game are you playing? What are you trying to accomplish? So the way the values, you know, the way you keep values from kind of overrunning the system, if you will, is to use values as context for a goal. So what are you trying to accomplish? So if everybody agrees that you're trying to accomplish this, everybody here wants to accomplish that. And if they all want to accomplish that, and the values are the rules that you're going to use to get there, the guideposts that you're going to use to get there, then the values will serve as context for making decisions. They aren't, you know, you're not making decisions to satisfy values. And so I think, to your point, you know, if you're going to try to do something, you know, that is worthwhile, something challenging, something big or something different, yeah, I think I've learned that there's a few things that I did wrong for many, many years. The first of which was you've got to get skilled people. You know, somebody, and I wish I could credit them with this because I live by it, is said, it's hard enough to make it to succeed with A players. Why would you try with B and C? And most people are going to be an A player somewhere in their life, but a lot of people aren't going to be an A player as we defined A player. So they're not right for here, but find A players. And A players are people that are skilled at what they do, have the values that we're looking for, have goals bigger than themselves, meaning they can't accomplish the goal by themselves. So by definition, they inherently believe in the concept of team because they need more people than themselves to get them to the goal. So you don't have to sell them on the idea of teamwork. And if their goals, if their life goals or career goals align with ours, you put those people into a system that really lives its values, and then you give ourselves a big enough goal and you can't really help but succeed. And then the system doesn't degrade into what you were describing, which is toxic as hell, because that's kind of what we had become around 2017.
I'm changing an organization. You have people in a team that, you know, there's always a spectrum of highly competent, wouldn't be without them, and behaviorally they're awesome as well. My gosh, if this person left, it would may not damage us, but it would be a real shame. All the way through to, I don't know why this bug is still working for us, but they seem to still be. And often it's because they're quite good at a very particular set of tasks. And actually, you know what? It's not that I couldn't go and get somebody else, but oh, it would just be such a pain to do so. I mean, I'm overdoing the spectrum. And then there are saboteurs, and then there are people that are on the fence. And there's all these variables, but the machine seems to be working. So when you reboot or you say, right, we're going to do something different, I think people intellectually, what they're really saying is, we really want everybody that we've got working here to get on board. Because actually, and if one person leaves, fine, but we really don't want problems, because it's the reality of dealing with an outflux of people and bringing new people in. And I do wonder when you say, you know, over the years, we've lost most of those 42, that could sound to some people like, well, blooming heck, you know, did you manage that badly? Or no, I was, well, maybe I could have done things differently, but no, what I did was I was willing to set a standard, and I was willing to deal with the pain if basically everybody looked at it and went, no, I'm not signing up to that. Or fine, then in that case, I'm going to start again. And I just wonder, you know, did you see it coming and were you prepared, or did you go, oh, hello? You know, what kind of happened there?
I love what you just said. I think that's such an important message for your listeners. It is not something I saw coming, but it makes 100% sense in hindsight. So, you know, only after, you know, I spent about a year just kind of in that self-discovery, like, what am I looking for? Why am I unhappy about this? What results would actually like make me happy before I actually started working on a weekly basis with my coach? So there was a little bit of runway between that day where I was like, okay, I got to change something, and the day where I got the coach. His process usually takes about 18 months. So we're about, in this case, 2 years into the change process. And there's been a lot of turnover at the company at this point. And he said this. He said, you could look at change, you know, these people leaving, as some form of failure. Like, boy, you're really doing this wrong. Or nobody was buying what you were selling, you know. And I don't mean customers. I mean, the staff really weren't, you know, buying in to what you were asking. But he said, like, you could hardly claim that you're changing and truly being somebody different if your world around you doesn't change. So if you actually went from being the company that you were to the company that you want, and all the same people were still there, you can hardly claim that anything's changed, because to be the company that you were required you to be a very different person than the person you have to become to get a different kind of company. When you become a different person, inevitably what made you attractive to the first group isn't going to make you attractive or appealing to the second group. So that attrition is actually evidence of change. Now, there was a lot of deep friendships. A lot of the people that we had at the time had been with us for 10 years or more. And I wish that they had wanted what I wanted. I wish they had valued what I valued. But, you know, I could have done a better job as a leader leading up to 2017, making it clear what I wanted so that nobody was surprised when I started, like, you know, redirecting us back to our core founding purpose. And, you know, it's unfortunate, but I do believe that, you know, the people that have left, and I've stayed in touch with a lot of them, they've all gone on to find places where there is a value match and perhaps a goal match. And the people that we have here, you know, absolutely love it. On a regular basis, we hear from the staff how much they enjoy having a place where, and they don't have the language for it necessarily, especially some of the newer team members, but they really enjoy the experience because they feel like they belong. They feel like we're trying to get to where they want to go.
Yeah, it feels right. And I've noticed this where I was director of leadership in a consultancy some years ago, and there's one or two people that were let go for various reasons, underperformance and et cetera. And they went on and they thrived. They thrived and they got promoted. And I look back and I go, wow, in 2 or 3 years, that I've just tracked them on LinkedIn. I've actually quite, you know, I've stayed in contact with them and sort of gone, hey, how are you? And they're doing incredibly well. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reason, it just wasn't the right place, the right space, the dynamic wasn't quite right, whatever it is. And yeah, so sometimes it's the wrong peg in the wrong hole, but very often it's not the wrong peg. It's just, it does fit, but it, you know, like those shoes I'm wearing, they're all right. And then you wear a pair that really fit you well and you go, oh, but these are awesome.
Right.
Yeah. And that's what it is. It's not that they were a faulty pair. It just wasn't as good as it could be. And I think that's why people stay in organizations, isn't it? Do I love it here? No, but it pays the bills. You know, I've got a comfort with it. I know my job. Unless I do something ridiculous, they probably wouldn't get rid of me. Do I love it? No. And then, and we look at the person, they go, are they great? Not really. Do they do a good job? Yes. Will I get rid of them? Well, it's not really worth it. So we're all living in this kind of quasi-average. You know, I'm being an average leader because I'm not really dealing with it. You're being an average employee because you're not really moving on. Not for me, you should move on, but for yourself, you should do.
Yeah.
And if you're not careful, you know, we get this kind of level of, this level that really isn't serving anybody. So it's brave if that individual goes, do you know what? And you get it, you know, I'm going to move on. And sometimes there's a little panic. Oh, no, don't move on. Yeah. And then I go, what? You know, why are you asking them not to move on? Can I have more budget to pay them more money? But you said you wish they didn't work here. What?
Exactly.
Why are you fighting to keep them? What you mean is you don't want to deal with the aggravation of them moving on, but you've been wishing for it for the last 2 years.
Yeah, you're afraid of the loss. I mean, here's the scarier part too. I mean, we're applying this thinking to business and team members and maybe staff. But how many people are in a relationship, whether it's a primary relationship or a friend's relationship, where, you know, it's not healthy, but you're not getting rid of it and you're not getting the results that you want? You know, I have 1,000 quotes that I try to live by, and, you know, I harvest them and I store them away. And one of the ones that, again, kind of resonated with me, and I wish I could give credit where it's due, but somebody said, you're the average of the 5 people that you hang out with most. And when you think about that and you ask yourself, like, look around your life and say, do you want to be the average of those people? Right. And I hold, you know, me and my executives to a standard that says, would we be one of the 5 that they want to hang out with? Can we develop the best in people? Are we making them better human beings with the time that we have them here at ThrillWorks? Or are we just trying to get some work out of them? Because that's unfulfilling, both for us as a company, for our customers, and for the person in question. So, you know, there's a standard that you can set that applies, that cuts clear across your life, friends, primary relationship, you know, and professional.
I was watching something on YouTube the other day, and again, this would be so more impressive if I could remember the gentleman's name, but he's a magician and he's a keynote speaking magician on sort of behaviors, and he does magic to prove some points. And he tells a story of, I think, training to be, he was either an accountant or I think a lawyer. He said he was doing a really good job at it. He said, I didn't really like it. He said, but every night after work, I would do magic for people. And said, and one day, he said, his boss comes down and he goes, hey, can I have a word? And he went, yeah. He said, if you're still here in a year, I'm going to let you go.
Good for him.
You know, why? Yeah, I think I'm doing a great job. No, you are doing a great job, but you're in the wrong job.
Good for him. That's true leadership, right? Like, that is good for him. Yeah. I think, you know, it's our job as, you know, to use the trust that people give us to help them understand, if they're willing, to help them understand how they're showing up in the world. And, you know, if this person in your story could see that the magician wasn't living up to their full potential, somebody has to say something to that person, because otherwise you're really doing a disservice to that person. They might think they're living the best version of their life, but if you said to them, hey, you have more potential than you're living into, and I see the potential as XYZ, like, hopefully that adds something to your life. They then have the choice to either, like, explore that potential, but again, you can't achieve something that you're unaware of. And if you do, it's called an accident, and you're probably not going to learn a lot from it, right? Because if you're not prone to reflecting on life, you're not going to learn a lot. We don't learn from experience. We learn from reflecting on experience. So I love that story. I love that somebody had the courage to go and say what needed to be said for that person's best interest.
And when I hear you say that, I also recognize that, but if you're going to make those kind of observations and offer them to people, there's a difference between saying to somebody, you're doing my head in, if you don't move on, I'll let you go, which is a completely different thing to, hey, as much as I value you here, you're not doing the right thing. You're not in the right place. But there is then something about, to make those kind of observations and to offer them, you've got to have your own stars aligned. You've got to be somebody that message is okay to receive it from. I've got to feel that coming from you, that's something I should listen to. So that's a key factor, I think.
I think that comes right full circle back to what we started with, and that is trust, right? If you are somebody that demonstrates integrity and, you know, you have trust in that person's eyes, then you can share stuff like that with them and they know that it's coming from a good place for good reason. If you walked up to somebody that you don't know and therefore have no trust with and you said, hey, move along or else, yes, of course it comes across as more threatening, right? More manipulative. And so it's not going to be reflected on or learned from. But I really do think, you know, for the relationships that we count on in our life, there needs to be a core foundation of trust. You need to show up with integrity and vulnerability. And I think it's the seed crystal for everything good that comes from life if you can actually form relationships rooted in that.
Well, one thing I'm interested in, Jay, is the, you know, it's often the role of the manager to take, to reinforce and calibrate and challenge. You know, I love what you're doing, do more of it. That's good. But yeah, if you just moved left instead of right, that would be even better. And hey, you know, what the Scooby-Doo are you doing there? We need to have a chat about that. Right. Boom. So those are the three things. I wonder how much within Thrillworks, and one of the things I try and encourage is that actually how much can the team I was going to say self-police, that is completely the wrong word, but be its own learning council to be able to say, listen, I observe this in you at peer level. I'm going to offer you my counsel. So actually, it's not the manager having to offer all the observations and all the coaching. Peer group teams are owning their own development. And I wonder how that, it sounds as if I think I know where your answer is going to go, but I'd just like to hear your kind of thoughts around that.
Yeah, I think it's fundamental. I think, again, if you're hiring skilled people that have goals, and a lot of those goals require development, otherwise they'd already have the goal they're after, they take to the idea of coaching beautifully, meaning our managers and our team leaders are taught, you know, we try to have a cascading approach to this where, like, I, as the leader of the executive team, will ask, you know, questions that help my team get to the answers. Now, they have skills I don't. So it's not just a dirty little trick to ask a question because I have the answer and I'm trying to get you there. But, like, I oftentimes know what the right question is. I just don't have the answer. But that's why you surround yourself with skilled people. And that is quite addictive. So it cascades through the organization because we ask our managers to behave this way. This is one of our values, the curiosity and the leadership. So ask questions of your team. And once they actually start experiencing that, hey, we're skilled, we know what the goal is, and as a community on this project, we can actually ask each other these on a regular basis. We don't actually have to wait for the manager to be here. So it almost becomes a flywheel effect where the team itself will start policing using the values as, you know, their framework, using the values as the rule set that they make decisions with, but they know what the goal is. So with goals and values and permission to be curious and vulnerable with one another, people can say, I'm not very good at this. Can I do what you're doing? Because I'm really good at that. And you do what I'm doing and we'll get to the goal faster. Because, you know, as I mentioned, like, you know, our intention here is instead of pressing harder on the gas pedal, why don't you take your foot off the brake? Right. Once we're sure that we've like figured out where we can like get rid of the friction in the system, then we're allowed to really speed up. Because otherwise, you know, you're just making the whole system work harder for like mediocre results. And I think a team thrives in this and has a while, and it's addictive. I mean, our customers turn out to be fanatical when they get to experience this. And this is what I was saying, like for the first 12 years, our customers loved how we showed up for them. And yes, they were very pleased with the outcome of our work, but it's how we show up, not what we do, that makes a real difference. And I think that's not just a Thrillworks thing. That's what I would share with any leader. Like, be clear on how you're doing things, not just what you're doing, because the delivery is, you know, equally as important.
I'm just making a note of something you said there, which is, you know, instead of pressing harder on the gas pedal, take your foot off the brake. I think that's it's the balance of those. Sometimes, you know, let's just go, right? But then sometimes let's get out of our own way.
Yeah, and exactly.
That's a great phrase. Look, I'm super alert to time. And I just want to say, first of all, you've been an absolute joy in terms of a conversation. I've thoroughly enjoyed this. So thank you so much, Jay. Any, you know, guy, if somebody said anything I should read, anything I should pay attention to, any podcasts I should tune into, you know, what's in your buffet of I would probably suggest you take a look at or read or pay attention to, just because it will add value. What would you offer?
Well, Leadership Bites podcast for sure.
Well done, sir. Well done.
But I think a lot of the material from Jim Collins, I'm a really, really, really big fan of. Patrick Lencioni uses a very, very different style. He is more narrative style. He tells a lot of fables to get his point across. Amazing. It's amazing work. His Five Dysfunctions of a Team taught me so much. And then I would say, you know, try to find yourself a peer group that is willing to hold you accountable to your goals and hold a mirror up to show you how you're showing up. So there's a lot of great literature out there. I actually have like a preferred reading list, and it's about, you know, 20 books long. And I go back through those books because every time you read them, you find something new because you're a little bit smarter than you were the last time you read them. But I think the best way of getting out of your own way is to surround yourself with people that will help you understand exactly how you're getting in your way. And that only happens in a live relationship. So we don't learn or grow outside of a relationship, because you need that to reflect back to you how you're showing up. So I would say find yourself a trustworthy peer group, and then, you know, find some reliable sources that aren't just opinion-based. That's why I like Jim Collins and Patrick Lencioni. They've done a lot of research that backs up some of their publishing.
And they're very digestible.
Yeah,
as well.
Agreed.
They're easy to read. So I would totally buy into that. Okay, so Jay, I'm going to wrap us up. I'm going to get you to stay on for a few moments so everything loads up. So I'll make sure that we don't have to do this again, because nobody's going to want to do that in the nicest possible way. So from me, from everybody that's listening, just thank you so much for taking the time to be on the podcast. Thank you.
I'm flattered to have been on the podcast. Thanks very much for having me. It's been like an absolute pleasure.
That's it. So I hope you enjoyed the episode. Please share so others get to hear about us, and subscribe so you keep up to date on new episodes. Also visit livingbrave.com if you want to connect with me and find out more about executive coaching, team effectiveness, and changing culture. Oh, and of course you can buy my book Living Brave Leadership on Amazon. So on that note, see you soon.